Hi there, my name is Jerem Bogwa, and I'm the host of Crime and Consequence Kenya, a true crime podcast where we tell the life stories of our victims, who they were, what happened to them, and why they still matter. Hi there, welcome to season 2 of Crime and Consequence KE. I am very excited for this season. I have great stories lined up. I have stories from all over the country. I have stories from just very many different perspectives, and I'm very, very excited to share them with you. And yeah, I've been gone for a while. I've been very busy. Life's been happening, and there's been so many moving parts. And honestly, I'm just one person, and there wasn't enough in my time to do everything that I do and also research for the podcast, you know, do the scripts and record and edit and just do all the things that I needed to basically have a podcast platform. So I just decided that the break was initially just supposed to be a couple of weeks, but I think it's been like 2 months because I'm recording this on the 17th of September, so it's been a while, but it's been good for me. I've been able to put my focus where it needed to be for that amount of time. I've been able to navigate a few things, and I've been able to reserve enough energy for myself to also navigate things that are cropping up. So now I am ready to be back. You know, the pieces are where they need to be. They are in place. I feel that I have enough energy, at least today, to record one or two episodes. And it's also a good step because there's also that is happening on that side. But also for me, it can extend from, oh yeah, I'm just resting until I feel rested enough to be able to take on this task, to now I was resting and then I got rested and then I just began procrastinating. So doing small things like, you know, when you have time here and there, you record the first maybe 2 episodes. And then from there, you just keep moving slowly until you make it. Our pledge today are James Kipkumei Koech, our victim, Jackson Kimeli Koech, the accused, Stella Cherotich, James's sister, and John Kipsiele Kitur, who was James and Jackson's friend. On 5th March 2015, at around 7 a.m., James Koech is at his house with his wife, his kids, and his sister Stella Cherotich. He tells them that he's headed to work, but he does not tell them where he's going to work for that day. So I'm assuming that James alikuwa anafanya vibarua here and there, and that day he'd gotten some casual work somewhere, and that's where he was headed for that morning. So he leaves at 7 a.m. and he goes to work with his neighbor, and his neighbor is the accused, Jackson Koech. And Jackson Koech was also James's cousin. So they were cousins and they were neighbors. That morning they were going to work together. So they go and they finish work at around 1 p.m. And instead of being paid in money, they were paid in busa, which is traditional Kenyan alcohol. So to be exact, busa is fermented beer that is made from maize, sorghum, or millet flour. So after they finished the constructing, whatever it is that they were constructing, this is when they were paid in the busa, and then they drank the busa. So now they've drunk the busa, so they're a bit drunk. So they head to the house of a woman who was identified as Alice Chebeto. Alice Chebeto was a busa seller who sold the busa from her house. And on the way to Alice's house, James and Jackson meet John Kipsiele Kitur, and James invites him to drink the busa that they were having and also join them in Alice's house. So the total number of people, according to James later on as he was testifying, the total number of people who went to Alice's house was 6. So before they finished the busa that James and Jackson had, they each decided to contribute some money towards buying changa at at Alice's house. So they each decided that everybody was going to contribute 10 shillings and then in total they were going to have 60 baht, and then they were going to go to Alice's house and buy changa that would get them lit. Pusa is a beer. Changa is a traditional homemade spirit that's popular in a lot of low-income areas in the country. Out of the six men, Jackson Koch does not contribute the 10 shillings for the changa. And for just a little bit, him not contributing the 10 bob creates a bit of tension between James and Jackson, the two cousins. So they have a little bit of an argument about like, why are you not contributing the 10 bob? I thought everybody was supposed to contribute to the 10 bob. You're going to drink to Alice's, like, you know, you're not going to just be drinking for free. And I'm just imagining that is what they were probably saying to each other. They have their little tiff and then they're like, we're still going to go drinking. So they continue on and they get to Alice's house. John, who is the one who had gotten the 60 bob, the 50 bob now, because remember Jackson didn't contribute, so they have 50 shillings in total. John goes and buys the changa from Alice and then they all start drinking. So the people who had contributed started drinking. Jackson Koech, he does not get a share of the changa because again, you did not contribute the 10 bob towards the changa. So we're not going to give you any of the changa. You can just sit over there and watch us drinking, you know, because we gave the money. So this, him not being given a share of the changas, that's another argument. He's causing commotion. He's angry. You know, he's demanding that he be given some share of the changa. He shared his busa. He's like, you know, you're my cousin. How can you just not share with me because of 10 bob? And this, that, and the other. And again, James just keeps on telling him, like, you didn't contribute the 10 bob that everybody else contributed towards the changa. So it's not fair for us to give you a share of what we worked so hard for. They're arguing back and forth, you know, I want the changa, we're not giving the changa. I want the changa, we're not giving the changa. So on seeing this, Alice is like, well, you know, first of all, it's men. There's six men in my house right now. And now they're drunk. On top of them being men, now they're drunk. Now they're drunk men in my house. First of all, there's just men in my house. And then number two is there's drunk men in my house. So she's like, all of you need to get up and get out of here. And later she would say in court, it was because she knew that they were going to get rowdy. And she knew that things were not going to end up good. Because again, it's men. And again, it's drunk men. So she told them that you guys have to leave. I don't have a liquor license. I'm not supposed to be selling anything from my house. And you guys are going to bring the cops here. You know, something is going to happen. So just leave my house. Leave my house. And according to John, none of the men really fight Alice. They all do as they're told and they all leave. According to John, when they leave Alice's house, James and Jackson, they shook hands and they shared a cigarette. So the little... So remember the first time they had a tiff, they had a small tiff before they went to Alice's house, but they quashed it. And then they went to Alice's house again, this time was a bigger argument. But according to John, after they left Alice's house, they shook hands and then they shared a cigarette. They said, you know what, we're cousins, you know, I'm sorry I didn't contribute the 10 bob, I'm sorry I didn't give you the alcohol, you know, next time we'll do better. And they walked away together, the three of them, John, James and Jackson, they walked away happily. And on the way to the next location, because they were not done drinking, they were going to find an indication to keep on drinking. So on the way to the next location, John is stopped by another man who's a friend of his and they start talking. And so James and Jackson proceed without him. A few minutes as John is talking to this older man, some school children come and tell him that one of his friends is lying down on the road and he's injured. And John is like, what do you mean? Like, I've just left them. They were fine. They were talking and everything. So John leaves his friend there and heads in the direction where James and Jackson had gone. John meets Jackson and he asks him, like, what happened? I'm hearing one of you is in pain. Were you fighting? What's going on? And Jackson, who's still drunk, all of them are actually still drunk at this point, Jackson tells him that yes, me and James fought because he was trying to fight me over the issue of the alcohol and I thought we had resolved that. And he just keeps on going to wherever it is that he was going. So John also heads off in the opposite direction looking for James, because he now realizes that it was James who was probably lying on the side of the road somewhere in pain. He does find James, and he was right. James was twisting in pain, and he kept on saying in Swahili that Jackson amenikanyaga kanyaga tumbo, which directly translates to Jackson was stepping on my stomach. At some point, John leaves James and he tells James, I'll be right back, but I need to go find somebody who can do more, because remember, we are still drunk. So I need to go find somebody who can get help to get you to the hospital or something. So he finds Joseph Kiptanduit in the vet, who turns out to be James's uncle. So Joseph was the younger brother of James's father, and that day he was headed to the Porsche Mill when he met John, and then John told him everything that had happened up until that point. So the two of them returned to where James was, and when Joseph saw James's condition, he called Stella, and when Stella got there, she would later testify in court that she didn't see any blood where James was lying, but her brother was still in a lot of distress. He was in a lot of pain. So when Stella gets there, she calls Joseph Tanui, and together they take James to the closest dispensary. At the dispensary, he's, you know, looked at Kidogo Kidogo. They ask him, he says tumbo, so they give him some painkillers, and then because that's as much as they can do, they refer him to Subukia Hospital. So Stella and Joseph decide to take James home because he had the painkiller, so they'll take him home that day. He'll get some rest, and then the next morning they would take him to Subukia Hospital. So they went home, but as the night was progressing, James's pain was getting worse and worse and worse. So at about 3 a.m., Stella again got a boda boda, and she and the boda boda person took James to Subukia Hospital, where he was treated and discharged. Despite taking his medication, at around 9 a.m. on March 6th, again his condition completely deteriorated. So James is not getting better. His condition is getting worse. And at some point that day of March 6th, Jackson arrives at James's home with his father, Joseph Tinderet, and they're there to talk to James's father and see if there's any way that they can come to a reconciliation and find a way to move forward as a family. So James's father, Wilson Lekaken Tinderet Simon, said that he had found out that his son had been hurt the previous night at 8 p.m. after his wife told him. When Jackson and his parents arrived at their home the following morning of March 6th, they told him that Jackson was really, really, really sorry. He had not meant to hit James, and he even committed to assisting the family with any hospital expenses that they had. Then he said that it was agreed in the family that they would discuss the matter with a view of reconciliation after James had recovered. To show their commitment and just to show how apologetic and sorry Jackson was, Jackson's parents gave Wilson $3,500 for James's hospital expenses. And then they went on about their day. So later that day, James was taken to Subukia Hospital. Then from Subukia Hospital, he was transferred to Nyahururu Hospital. And then eventually, as the doctors were like, there's nothing we can do at this particular hospital, again, he was transferred to Provincial General Hospital in Nakuru. He would stay at the hospital for about 9 days until, unfortunately, on March 15th, 2015, James died as a result of his injuries. After the assault had happened, court documents show that Joseph Tindere is the person who made a report to the DCI at their offices in Subukia. Police started the investigations into the incident, and after James died, they began looking for Jackson. Now he was being officially charged with murder. However, after the death of James, Jackson completely disappeared. He was nowhere to be found. On March 18th, a post-mortem was conducted on the body by Dr. Titus Ngulungu at the Provincial General Hospital in Nakuru at the request of the police. Dr. Titus stated that James did not have any external injuries, but the body had cyanosis and his abdomen was swollen and full of air. I did some research, and according to the Cleveland Clinic, cyanosis is a medical term for when your skin, lips, or nails turn blue due to a lack of oxygen in your blood. The postmortem also showed that internally, James's abdominal wall was bruised, his intestines were red and inflamed and perforated, meaning that there was a hole. And according to the doctor, James's death was caused by blunt force trauma to the abdomen and viscous perforation peritonitis coming from shock caused by the hole. According to Google, viscous perforation peritonitis refers to a serious condition where a hole develops in the wall of the digestive organs, causing a leaking of their contents into the abdominal cavity. This leakage irritates the lining of the abdomen, leading to inflammation called peritonitis. This condition is a surgical emergency and it requires a prompt diagnosis and immediate treatment. So, you know, the painkillers that James was being given were not really doing anything for him. He needed to be properly diagnosed with this condition and then given surgery to try and repair the hole that was in his digestive organs. So that is why he died. Let's move on to the arrest and the defense. Almost 3 years go by without Jackson being found. They don't know where Jackson is. But on June 10th of 2018, he was finally arrested by members of the public at Mau in Narok. On June 11th, the next day, police went and rearrested Jackson and officially charged him with the murder of James. He was presented in court on June 12th, and that is when his case began. In his defense, Jackson stated that on March 5th, 2015, he and James did go to Alice's house to take Busa, and they became very drunk and loud. This is when Alice ordered them to finish their alcohol and leave her house because she did not have a liquor license and she completely refused to sell them any more alcohol. She wanted them gone from her property. So Jackson tells the court that after Alice orders them to leave, they just, you know, they're trying to finish their alcohol as fast as possible, so they leave. So because of basically gulping down large amounts of alcohol quickly, they became very drunk in a very short amount of time. Like, they became drunk very, very quickly. So as a result of them becoming extremely drunk very quickly, they were staggering as they walked home. Now he's referring to himself and James and also John. So he says that the footpath that they were using to get home was rough and they kept falling and helping each other up. And as a result of this, Jackson said he could not tell whether James was hurt by one of the falls because he's like, there are large rocks on this road. It's just a rough, rough road to be walking on. And because we're so drunk, we're staggering, we're falling, maybe he got hurt when he fell and he was hit by one of these rocks. Or, you know, sometimes there are even logs of trees that are just in the road. Maybe he was hit by a tree. And that is when he got the injury. I could not tell you. Jackson told the court that he found out about James the next day when Joseph and two other people went to his house to inquire about how much alcohol they had drunk the previous day. Jackson said that he had injuries on his left leg when he woke up that day, but he could not remember how he got them. He added that he visited James and even asked him how they had gotten the injuries, like, how did you get hurt in your stomach and how did I get all these injuries on my leg? So as he was visiting James, he said that he noticed James was not well and learned his parents wanted to sell a cow to take him to hospital, but because he had some money, he offered it to them. He says after James was taken to Nyahururu Hospital, he left his shamba, and his shamba was at Mount Narok, and it was while he was there in his shamba in Mount Narok that he learned that James had died on March 15th. He said Joseph Tenderet, the same person who is, according to court documents, is the same person who reported this to the DCI, Joseph Tenderet advised him to stay there in Mau so that the two families could discuss what had happened and determine a way forward. He said that he stayed in Mau Narok but would go home often, and so he was saying this to dispute the claim that he had been hiding for 3 years. He said, I don't know why you guys, I constantly came home, but I was told to primarily stay in Mau Narok as the two families decided how we were going to figure out a way to reconcile. He said that on March 5th, he did not argue with James, but with another man referred to as Joseph Kipsiele. He said that he and James were good friends and had known each other since childhood. He also added the death was as a result of drunkenness, and he wondered why he was being blamed. It was like everybody was very, very drunk. We drank busa, we drank changa, and everybody was really drunk. It was probably an accident and nobody's fault. Jackson's lawyer, who was only identified as Miss Chemgetich, said that James and Jackson had resolved their differences, and there was even a witness who was saying that he had seen them share a cigarette after leaving Alice's house. She also said that there was no witness to this crime, like nobody saw Jackson hitting James, nobody saw them fighting, nobody saw this crime happening, so nobody can say for sure what had happened. She added that John, James's uncle, had testified the families resolved the issues, and Jackson even contributed to the medical bills of James. She said Jackson had only gone to Mauna Rock as instructed to allow room for reconciliation. He had never... And she also added that Jackson never had any intention to hurt James. James was his childhood friend. He was family. He was his cousin. And you see, if they were doing things like walking together and then drinking together, it means that they had a very close relationship. So he's like, you know, basically blame it on the alcohol, but it wasn't my client's fault that, you know, any of this happened. So Jackson's defense argued against the murder charge and stated the case lacked the necessary ingredients of murder, and if Jackson intended to kill James, he would not have assisted in his treatment, and furthermore, Jackson could not remember the attack because they were both very, very drunk. But remember that when John found James, James was saying that ni Jackson amenikanyaga kanyaga tumbo. So even if Jackson could not remember, it might be argued that James actually did say who did, you know, who hurt him as his kind of his dying declaration or something. Jackson's defense argued against the murder charge and stated the case lacked the necessary ingredients of murder, and if Jackson intended to kill James, his childhood best friend, his longtime cousin, somebody that he was comfortable enough to work with and drink with, he would not have assisted in his treatment, and furthermore, Jackson could not remember the attack because they were both very, very drunk. Jackson's lawyer urged the court to acquit Jackson, but if they found otherwise, he should only be charged with manslaughter but not murder. Now, one of the prosecution's arguments in this case was that Jackson had disappeared for 3 years after James died because he did not want to face the consequences of his actions. Let's take a look at this alleged disappearance. Jackson claims that he had been advised to stay away so that the two families could discuss how to reconcile after James died. However, Jackson's father, Wilson, denied that his family agreed for Jackson to go live in Mount Narok pending reconciliation. He said in his testimony that Jackson had gone into hiding after James died. Now, Wilson's brother, John, testifies that Jackson's family had attempted reconciliation after the incident when they gave money for James's treatment. He said it was also discussed after the death that if an agreement was to be reached, the family of the accused would pay 9 head of cattle. He confirmed that it was also agreed Jackson would leave his family for a while, but the only thing that they had not agreed is where Jackson would go. But Jackson ended up in Mount Narok. However, he also said that when Jackson heard James had died, he ran away. When he was re-examined, he confirmed that Jackson had left as agreed when James was in hospital, but after his death, he had disappeared. He said the reconciliation efforts collapsed after the death. He clarified his earlier statement and said there were no agreement that the accused would leave home, and reiterated that he ran away after learning of the death of James. There was a bit of miscommunication because a lot of the evidence and a lot of the weight of this case was carried by testimonies. So when James's father testified, he said that no, my family and I did not agree to any type of reconciliation, and this person definitely ran away so that he could not be charged with the murder of my son. When John was asked, James's uncle, initially he said that, I mean, I was there there and they were making efforts towards reconciliation, and then they say for them to be able to reconcile, James has to go away for a while, Jackson has to go away for a while because James had died. And he said that and then he changed his mind again and said, actually, you know what, they actually never had talked about any reconciliation. And what really happened is that when Jackson heard that James had died, he disappeared and nobody knew where he went. So that is the whole scope of this alleged disappearance of Jackson. So the state in this case was represented by a lawyer identified as Miss Murunga, who argued the prosecution had proved its case beyond any reasonable doubt using the testimony of the 8 witnesses presented. She argued that if the two had really solved their issues, Jackson would not have run away from the crime scene, leaving James helpless. Because remember, when John was told by those children that one of his friends was lying on the road, the first person he met before he got to James was Jackson, and Jackson was headed in the opposite direction. So the state argued that if you guys were such good friends, if you guys were so close, you had not done anything to hurt James, then why would you leave him in pain and just walk away? So she added, Jackson had disappeared after James was hospitalized and would not be found for another 3 years because he knew that he was guilty of murder, and he knew that if he was to be found and arrested, he would be convicted of murder. She said that even without eyewitnesses, all the circumstances point to guilt. She said that whether or not Jackson intended to hurt James is immaterial because his actions still had the intent to cause grievous harm. The prosecution added there was no evidence that Jackson or his family had contributed towards James's medical bills, because remember, it said that when Jackson and his parents that they went to Wilson, they gave him cash. They insisted the injuries that led to the death of James were caused by Jackson. The prosecution urged the court to find him guilty of murder and definitely not manslaughter. This case was heard before Judge Mumbuati Madeka, who said the prosecution had the burden of proving murder beyond any reasonable doubt. The judge said, while there was no eyewitness to the assault, the evidence of the attack came from the deceased himself as he lay in pain after Jackson had kicked him in the abdomen. He told his sister, his father, John, that it was Jackson who had attacked him. He kept on repeating that it's Jackson who stomped on his stomach. It's Jackson who stomped on his stomach. The judge said that the statements turned out to be dying declarations as captured under Section 33 of the Evidence Act, which states, when the statement is made by a person as to the cause of his death or as to any of the circumstances of the transaction which resulted in his death, in cases in which the cause of that person's death comes into question, such statements are admissible whether the person who made them was or was not at the time when they were made under expectation of death, and whatever may be the nature of the proceeding in which the cause of his death comes into question. Basically, he meant that James accusing Jackson was going to be allowed in court as evidence. On whether Jackson could use intoxication as a defense, because remember that his lawyer said that he was so drunk that he could not remember what had happened. So how could you blame somebody for doing something that they didn't even know that they were doing? So on whether Jackson could use intoxication as a defense, the judge quoted Section 13, Subsection 2 of the Kenya Penal Code. A summary of this section, according to Google, states that voluntary intoxication is generally not a defense to a criminal charge, but it can be a defense if the person was so intoxicated that they did not know their act was wrong, or they did not know what they were doing, and either the intoxication was caused without their consent by someone else's actions, or they were temporarily insane due to the intoxication. So basically, if you take yourself to the bar and you're voluntarily taking this shot, and then after you get fucked up, you go and you do something criminal, you can't say, oh my god, it's because I was so drunk that I did this thing. And if you're going to use that as a defense, then there are like small kind of loopholes on when you can try and use it, but generally you can't use voluntary intoxication as a defense. On the intoxication defense, the judge said, in the instant case, there is evidence from Alice and John that both the accused and the deceased had been drinking before the incident. There is, however, no evidence that the accused was so drunk that he did not know what he was doing with the meaning of Section 13 of the Penal Code. The accused narrated before this court the chronological events of that day. He stated vividly that he was working with the deceased and they were paid with alcohol, which they drank before leaving Alice's place to drink more. He remembered they quarreled with the deceased, necessitating Alice to order them to leave her place. He remembered that Alice had told them to finish their alcohol quickly and leave. He was aware that the footpath on their way home was rough and that he was with the deceased. He could recall that both of them were so intoxicated that they were falling down and getting up and assisting each other. He could recall the point where they parted ways. According to him, the deceased told him he was very drunk and the accused left him on the roadside while he proceeded with the journey to his home, which was nearby. It's not clear why the accused could not remember whether the deceased fell on a stone or stump and injured himself or whether he pushed him, yet he could remember every other thing that happened. The fact that the deceased did not have any other injuries on the body externally is indicative that the alleged numerous falls never took place. There was no evidence that the accused suffered the injury he alleged to have sustained. There is consistent evidence that there was a quarrel between the accused and James, and the accused intended to hurt James. From the evidence on the record, it is evident that the drink the accused had consumed had not impaired his judgment to the extent it would amount to excusable intoxication or render him incapable of forming the specific intent essential to constitute malice afterwards. So the judge added, what is clear, however, is that the accused, while under the influence of alcohol, hit his cousin and friend in the abdomen so hard that it caused a perforation in the stomach, leading to his death. While the set of facts before me clearly indicate that his actions caused the death of the deceased, those set of facts don't show that he intended to kill him. Now, on 5th November 2021, 6 years after the fact, Judge Mumbuti Matheka delivered his ruling. He said, and I quote, "In this case, I have come to the conclusion that the accused person, while guilty of the act that led to the death of the deceased, had no intention of killing him. I come to the final holding that the accused is guilty of manslaughter, contrary to Section 202 as read with Section 205 of the Penal Code. I find him so guilty and convict him accordingly." On February 1st, 2022, Jackson was set to receive his sentencing. His lawyer again told the court that Jackson, who was 45 at the time, was an only child to his parents, who were aged 68 and 74. She added that he was very remorseful about what he had done and urged the court to reconsider the time that he had already spent in custody. The judge referred to a probation officer's report that stated the accused came from a community that is very communal and people help each other. Men join each other to take alcohol and help a woman build a house. And after they help the woman build a house, they accept the drink as paid. And so the report also stated that when one of them is in trouble, they still come together and they assist one another. The report added they don't like disputes that escalate to this formal system of justice because it's foreign to them. It added that evidence for this was in how the two families came together to pay the medical bills and continued to hold talks of reconciliation before and after the death of James. A community that recognizes that it is not always that causing death, a death will call for punishment, but for appeasing of the spirit. The report demonstrated that the family and the community await the return of the accused person. They were willing to welcome Jackson back into their community. It stated that Jackson regrets what happened, and they also understand that the excessive drinking that had happened that day led to the events, and unfortunately, it also led to the death of James, who was Jackson's cousin and a close friend. So based on this particular report, the judge said the accused has been in custody since 12th June 2018, about 4 years. The probation officer recommends 3 years probation supervision. That would make a total of 7 years, 4 years in custody and 3 in the community. The officer has unfortunately not indicated what he intends to do with the accused for the 3 years. He has not indicated what treatment treatment plan. He has for the accused person to warrant a 3 years probation supervision, and it would only continue to delay the final determination of this case to ask for a further report. The judge added that to the extent that the report does not set out what the accused person will be doing for 3 years under the probation supervision, and in light of the circumstances of the offense and the prevailing circumstances in the family and the community, 3 years would be on the higher side. So I take into consideration the community's attitude towards the alternative dispute resolution, which they take to without any prompting. The accused would be placed on probation supervision for 18 months to enable him to settle back into the family and the community. The additional condition to the probation order is that the accused is to avoid excessive consumption of alcohol. So he reduced the probation period from 3 years to 18 months, and the only condition for that probation period was to avoid excessive consumption of alcohol, which I wonder, like, how would they measure that? You know, is excessive 2 drinks, 3 drinks? It just sounded very like a small slap on the wrist, you know, like, let me just give you this so that the court did, you know, the court can be seen that it did something, is what I feel. That is the story of James Kipkumei Koech. And that is how the story ended. And this was a very interesting story because, A, it's the first story where the judge really took into consideration the fact that his community did not want him to go to prison. They wanted him to go back home. And he was like, if this is what you guys want, you guys can have him. You know, if you guys want to rehabilitate him, we're not going to necessarily put him in prison. You guys can have him. But I also looked at, because this happened in a very, 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 very small village. It happened in Simboyon Village, Subukia Sub-County, Nakuru County. And I know a lot of you listening to this, you only know about probably you know some bit about Subukia and Nakuru, but you know where Simboyon Village is on the map. So I feel that it was very interesting that the judge was actually like, yeah, you know, if your community wants to take you back, then your community can have you. And the only thing I'm going to tell you is don't drink too much busa. And nobody really questioned or asked, like, what is too much busa? But yeah, this was a very interesting ending to a very sad story, actually. It's very, very sad that James lost his life over something as trivial as 10 bob, because if we're still arguing about that 10 bob, it's very, very sad that he lost his life over 10 shillings. And it's very, very sad that I don't see where Jackson really takes accountability for what he did. I don't see him saying that I did this and I apologize and I didn't mean to do it. I see a lot of excuses. I see a lot of deflecting. You know, there's no really like, I was drunk, I was mad, I wasn't thinking straight, I hit him, I kicked him, and I'm sorry. It's, you know, I didn't do it, or maybe even if I did it, I was so drunk I can't even remember. I don't really see where he took actual accountability for his actions, for what he did. And I feel that he got off very, very lightly, because he only spent about 4 years in jail, and then after that was given 18 months probation. And I mean, I know he's charged with manslaughter, and but I feel like it's still, because I wonder, like, when he went to his community, like, what do you think? When he went back to his community, how are they reinforcing the condition of his probation, of him not drinking excessively? Like, did he have to report to somebody? Was there consequences for when he got too drunk? Was he offered rehabilitation services, you know, outside of the community, coming back and you being told don't drink again? Like, was he offered any rehabilitation services? I wonder also how that impacted the families. Like, did they ever really reconcile? Because one part of the family is saying that you guys say that we can have a reconciliation. The other side of the family is saying that we never said anything like that. And then again comes this probation officer's report, and the report states that the families actually had decided that they were going to have talks and try to reconcile. And I was thinking about that, and I was like, I wonder if it's a case of where they were actually, they may have been having the talks and talking about reconciling, but maybe the amount of money or the amount of cattle or the amount of whatever, the compensation that was asked for by James's family, may have been something that Jackson's family was not willing or not able to offer. And that is what was probably causing the crumbling of the reconciliation efforts. And maybe that's why there was so much back and forth of there are talks about reconciliation, and this other side is there not talks about reconciliation. Because maybe the stipulation for that reconciliation was, we are only going to dismiss this case, we're only going to not take this further if you give us, you know, this and that amount of money. And that's the only amount of money we're going to expect, especially after James died, you know. And maybe this other family was like, we can't afford that, what if we did this? And they're like, no. And so maybe that's where the back and forth, the push and pull came. But I really wonder how Jackson being released with just 18 months probation and having served for 4 years, I wonder how it impacted the family. And I wonder what kind of life James, because this happened where, oh, I don't know why I thought this happened in 2005. This happened in 2015. So if all these people are still alive, I am curious. I would be curious to see where they are today. But enough of my rambling. That is the story of James Koech. And I've come to the end of this episode. I rambled on for 55 minutes. But I'm so excited to be doing season 2 again. I'm so happy that I get to do this. This is my happy place. This podcast is my happy place. It gets stressful, but it's a good kind of stressful. You know, it's the kind of stressful where you're like, I would rather really be stressed about this than about, you know, other things. So if you have made it to the end of this episode, thank you so much for making it to the end of this episode. I know that when I was finishing up season 1 last time, I said that would add more segments to the show, and adding more segments to the show is basically just me just rambling after I finish telling you the story, and then now I tell you my thoughts, because these 2 months that I've been off, I've been consuming a lot of 48 hours. If you're a fan of true crime and maybe you need some new true crime content, I highly recommend 48 hours. 48 hours is like, I love everything about 48 hours. They're so dramatic, but they tell their stories so well. I love 48 hours. I'm a big, big favorite of 48 hours. And then if you're also looking for a podcast this podcast is very niche. It's a true crime podcast, but it's very, very niche. It discusses true crime cases that revolve around Black women in the United States. And it's actually where I got the idea for the format of Crime and Cons. So it's called Sisters Who Kill. Sisters Who Kill is amazing. They're fantastic storytellers, and they just tell true crime in such a nice way. I like their format of storytelling. And yeah, I borrowed some ideas from them. And yes. Okay, now I'm done with episode 1. I hope to see you guys in episode 2. We're going to be looking at a brand new story. And don't forget, the podcast is now not hosted on Spotify. I'm now hosted on AfriPod. So go download the AfriPods app. There's an app. It's such a good app. It has so many different podcasts. Go and download the AfriPods app and add my podcast, Crime and Consequence KE by Njeri Mbogwa, on your AfriPods so that you never miss an episode. You can still find me on Spotify, Crime and Consequence KE. I'm also on Apple Podcasts, Crime and Consequence KE. And I'm also on Castbox, Crime and Consequence KE. And you can also interact with me on my social media. Give me a 5-star rating on Spotify. You can interact with me on my social media. Give me a 5-star rating everywhere, because actually I think if you're listening on Apple, you can give me a 5-star rating on Apple. If you're listening on Spotify, you can give me a 5-star rating on Spotify. I don't know if you can give me a 5-star rating on AfriPods, but you can definitely add my show as one of your favorites, and then tell a friend to tell a friend to tell another friend about this wonderful true crime Kenyan show. Where was I? You can also follow me on social media. I am Crime and Cons KE on Instagram. I'm Crimes and Cons KE on TikTok. And I am Crime and Consequence KE on Facebook. And I'm also Crime and Consequence KE on YouTube, because I thought it would be fun to explore more demographics, you know, for season 2. So I'm very, very excited for this season. I'm really hyped. I'm really happy. And I hope you guys stay with me. If longer form episodes like this are better, please let me know. And if you don't like them, also let me know. But anyway, thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for staying with me. Thank you for giving me a 5-star rating. Thank you for following me on Instagram, on TikTok, on Facebook. Thank you for subscribing on YouTube. Thank you for sharing this podcast with a friend. You know, just thank you for doing all these little nice things that make my podcasting life happy. Thank you for commenting. Thank you for liking. Thank you for interacting with my stories. Welcome to season 2, and I will see you guys on the next one.